standing. Hear me closely. This understanding will find new life. And here's how we
It's the Law of FOHO podcast, providing a combination of serious discussion of political, cultural, and social issues, along with witty and satirical humor, connecting listeners with the news they need to know in a fast-moving format. The son of immigrants and the new voice for conservative millennials, Robert FOHO blends his passion for conservatism with his view that America is the greatest country on earth, and our last best hope. Now, here's Robert.
Folks, I've got good news and I've got bad news. First, the good news. Joe Biden spoke yesterday concerning the Pfizer vaccine for the coronavirus, and he was able, get this, he was able to string two sentences together without suffering from menstrual cramps. The bad news is he sounded like such a downer. I could not deal with listening to the guy. He made me depressed just sitting there and listening to this. All the stuff he was saying. I mean, whew. But greetings, folks. Welcome to the Law of FOHO podcast. I am your host, Robert FOHO. That's FOHO with a soft J. Always make sure they pronounce your name right. I'm a recovering lawyer turned legal and political commentator. This is the show that is more like a classroom. We advance conservatism for you, a new generation, and we teach you that liberalism and voter fraud are the disease, and conservatism, thank God, is the cure. I'm thrilled to be here with you today. Biden, yesterday, oh man, this is one of the things I hate. Hate's a strong word, okay? My first grade teacher told me never to use the word hate. It's a strong word. Here's one of the things I cannot stand about liberals. They are so pessimistic. Liberalism is such a downer of a political philosophy. They're constantly telling you that your life sucks. They're constantly telling you that you suck. They're constantly telling you that you can't do anything because you belong to this group or that group, or because you're this or you're that, or you're from here or you're from there. And then they use that to sell you their latest and greatest government program, that they want you to vote for them so that they can then implement this program, and it's going to cost us X amount of dollars and so they'll raise taxes on everybody else. It's such a crappy philosophy because it's constantly putting you down. It's constantly depressing you. Conservatism is an optimistic philosophy. It is a vibrant and bright way of life. Conservatism teaches you that you are a unique individual with a unique skill set, and that you can achieve your dreams and your goals. And the goal of conservatism is to get government out of the way so that you can do that, because you don't need anybody else to achieve your goals. You don't need any help. You can do it yourself. It's about rugged individualism. We are all innate. We have talent that we can use to achieve whatever means and ends we want. Liberalism destroys that mindset completely. So yesterday you have Biden. First, he celebrates the vaccine. Okay, fine. But then he just goes south so fast. So he says, I congratulate the brilliant women and men who helped produce this breakthrough and to give us such cause for hope. But then he goes on. At the same time, it is also important to understand that the end of the battle against COVID-19 is still months away. Like, come on, Joe. I mean, can you throw us a bone? I mean, the media proclaimed president-elect is, you know, you should try and raise people's spirits, you know, try to cheer people up. But no, he keeps going. Americans will have to rely on masking, distancing, contact tracing, hand washing, and other measures to keep themselves safe well into next year. Today's news is great news, but it doesn't change that fact. Thanks, Joe. Let me go stick a knife in my eye. May as well stick my head in the oven while I'm at it, and then stick bicycle spokes in. I'll stop there. Let me tell you something. I cannot stand face masks. And here he is hinting at face masks, that we're going to have to continue wearing face masks because it's somehow the right thing to do. And he has hinted elsewhere at a national mask mandate if he does assume the office of the presidency, even though the president of the United States does not have the authority to implement a national mask mandate, nor does Congress. The federal government does not have the authority under the Constitution to tell you what to do simply because you exist while you are within your own state's borders. The federal government does not have the authority to do that. So that will be an interesting process if Biden does assume the presidency and attempt to implement such a mandate. But I don't think that's going to happen. But going back to my point before I went off on that tangent, I cannot stand face masks. And we have gotten to a point in society in this so-called pandemic that where face masks are becoming a determining factor in dividing society into two different groups. You got the maskers and the anti-maskers. I cannot stand these things, and they should be called face diapers. That's the more appropriate term for these stupid things that people are wearing on their faces. I learned a lot about face masks in connection with the lawsuits that I've been handling in New Hampshire. One of the lawsuits I filed was against the city of Nashua. They passed an ordinance requiring people to wear face masks when they enter any business or any common areas of commercial buildings or residential buildings that have a certain number of units or more. One of the things we did in that lawsuit was we had a hearing on a request for an injunction against the ordinance, and I hired an infection control epidemiologist from Canada who was well-versed in the coronavirus. He had given over 400 interviews on COVID-19, and he was an expert in public health, and he knew anything and everything there was to know about face masks. And I learned three things from him that we communicated to the court during that hearing. Number one, a face mask does not protect the person wearing the mask from contracting the virus, unless it is an N95 mask, which is the type of mask that physicians wear. It's the type of mask that my dad and other physicians wear when they are performing surgery. Any other kind of mask does not protect you from contracting anything. The second point he made was, masks do capture your own respiratory droplets that you emit. And that's apparently how the virus is transmitted, on these respiratory droplets that are in the air. But that is assuming that you are wearing the mask properly. And no one wears these things properly because they don't know how to wear them. I have flown to Miami twice during the summer, during this so-called pandemic. We flew down. In one of the trips, we connected in LaGuardia. And on the way back, and on the way back, we didn't connect. But we had to wear a mask the minute we walked into the airport, at our departure, and until we arrived in Miami and walked out of the airport down there. It was terrible wearing these things for several hours. But, you know, I'm watching my son, who's 10, wear a mask, and it's a freaking joke. I mean, he's wearing it. It's dangling off of his ear. Even when he has it on his face, it's you know, half of it's off. It's completely porous. It's a joke to make people wear masks because they don't know how to wear them. And then there's a ton of literature out there that suggests that the cloth masks, those trendy cloth masks that people are wearing and are buying, those are completely ineffective. Either way, either in protecting you from contracting the virus or in capturing your respiratory droplets. The third point this gentleman helped me communicate to the court was that wearing a mask poses serious health risks. So when you're wearing a mask, it's trapping the space around your face, and thus you are breathing in your own carbon dioxide. When you breathe in your own carbon dioxide, you're reducing the oxygen level in your blood. When you reduce the oxygen level in your blood, that compromises your immune system. When your immune system is compromised, guess what? You are now more susceptible to contracting viruses. So there's no point to any ordinance or mandate anywhere in this country that requires people to wear masks. They are not completely ineffective. They are largely ineffective, and I'm over masks. I work out every day. I do CrossFit. By the way, do you know how to tell if someone does CrossFit? They'll tell you that they do CrossFit. So I go to this CrossFit gym down the street. I've been going there for about 2.5 years. I loved it there. I love the community. I love the people call it a cult. They make fun of us, but it's been a wonderful revelation in my life doing CrossFit. My CrossFit gym decided to implement a mask policy. And the policy was this: if you walk in to the gym, you have to wear a mask. When you begin to warm up, you can take the mask off. When you go and obtain your equipment, your barbell, your kettlebell, your weights, your dumbbell, whatever you need to put the mask back on. When you return to your space and to begin the workout, you can take the mask off. When you're done with the workout, you need to put the mask back on to put all the weights and equipment back and to leave the gym. So the gym owners posted this policy on the gym Facebook page, and I could not stay silent, because it is the most asinine policy that I have ever seen. And I went at it with the owners, in a very polite way with my usual dose of sarcasm. I tried to explain how ineffective such a policy was, how silly it was. I offered some points about the efficacy of masks and so on and so forth. Anyway, I even threatened to leave the gym, and they decided to dig their heels in and keep the policy in place. I asked them to rescind it. They didn't want to. So they kept the policy in place, and I cut ties with the gym. So I am now a CrossFit free agent, and I'm looking around for a gym, and I've actually contacted a couple that do not have mask policies. So I'm a free agent. I'm going to be making some recruiting trips to other CrossFit gyms, and I'm going to, I have a criteria for the kind of gym I want to join. I'm going to do a few recruiting trips. I'm going to take my time. I'm going to make a decision. I'll probably announce my decision on primetime on ESPN, and Pitbull will likely be performing. But one of the funny things that happened in that comment thread on the gym Facebook group when they announced the new policy, one of the members of the gym asked, "Well, what do, when we take the mask off, during warm up or during the workout, where do we put it?" And I responded, "Well, you hang the mask in the mask hanging section. There's going to be a separate mask hanging section where you can put your mask, and then you can go retrieve it when it's time to put the mask back on during one of these other arbitrary segments of the time that you spend in the gym when you are required to wear a mask." So I'm over the whole mask thing. I can't stand them, and I think we're losing our minds as a society with these masks. So moving on here, remember when Al Gore was down in Florida after two recounts and he decided to sue the Florida Secretary of State? And then the media completely dismissed his efforts, declared George W. Bush the winner, and Bush gave this glorious acceptance speech on primetime TV on Saturday night, and the media hailed it as the second coming of John F. Kennedy? No, you don't remember that. That never happened. The media did not declare that Bush won. Instead, it waited 37 days until December 12, 2000, for Gore's lawsuit to go all the way up to the United States Supreme Court and be resolved. When the Supreme Court reversed the Florida Supreme Court's decision, effectively handing Bush a Florida victory and its very much coveted electoral votes, the media begrudgingly declared Bush had won the election. Gore held a press conference, and he explained he had called then-Governor Bush and offered his concession, and then Bush took it from there. And then you know what the media did? When Bush was inaugurated, it turned into a constant campaign to delegitimize him. In 2016 and 2017, in much the same way, it was all about Russian collusion concerning Trump, to make it seem like Trump stole the election from Hillary. That way, the Democrats could paint the picture that Trump was not a legitimately elected president. They did the exact same thing to George W. Bush in 2000, in 2001, 2002. The Democrats, they had the same three or four plays in their playbook, people. They're a one-trick pony. They're like a basketball team that always passes it to the star player, and you know exactly what play they're going to run. They're very, very predictable. So when a president is elected that they don't like, they try and attack his or her legitimacy. When they run out of things to do or things to attack, then they play the race card. With George W. Bush, they claimed he didn't win the popular vote, that he didn't really win Florida, or that he won by a margin of just several hundred votes. Whatever they could come up with, they would use to paint the picture that he was not, like Trump, legitimately elected. Republicans back then, they stayed calm. They let the process play out when Gore filed that lawsuit. They awaited the result in a calm and professional manner. It's the same thing Trump supporters are doing now. By the way, did you notice that there hasn't been a single, ever since Biden was proclaimed the winner of the election by the media? By the way, if you can point to whatever section of the Constitution or statute or applicable regulation that dictates that the media declares the winner of the election, let me know, because I have not been able to find it. But did you notice that ever since Biden was proclaimed the winner of the election by the mainstream media, there hasn't been a single riot or violent protest since all this went down? That's remarkable, isn't it? I wouldn't even know how to riot. I've never rioted in my life. I would be really new to it. Where do I start? Do I go to Home Depot? Do I start there? Bed Bath & Beyond? At least at Bed Bath & Beyond, I can pick up a new charcuterie board before I sucker punch the cashier. But do I bring rocks, sticks? Where do I get the rocks? Can I buy them somewhere? Can I order them on Amazon? Because I don't want to go outside and get dirty. That can be a little metro sometimes. I dress well. I practice good hygiene. So this is all foreign territory for me. And I mean, here's the other problem. I have kids. So do I get a babysitter? to watch them while I go out and riot, or do I bring the kids with me? Is this a family affair? I usually have my kids do chores, so how about if I just send the kids to do the rioting in my stead? That'd be a fantastic life experience for them when you think of it. Like, hey, kids, listen, whenever you get upset about something, go out and destroy something. Oh, man, this Democrat Party, they make John F. Kennedy turn over in his grave. JFK wouldn't have been let into the Democratic National Convention this past year. He's too right-wing for that party these days. There's a lot going on. When the media proclaimed Biden the winner on Saturday morning, there were two reactions among Trump supporters. Many of them were instantly depressed. They looked at that proclamation and began to swallow it as a difficult reality. I had friends and family texting me who were in that boat. They were saying, oh, hey, it's over. We need to prepare ourselves for a Biden presidency. But then there are people like me and a lot of other people that I know, actually, who had a different reaction. Our reaction to Biden being declared the winner and Biden having this pep rally on primetime TV on Saturday night and the media charging ahead with stories about what Biden is going to do to reverse Trump's policies, et cetera, et cetera. Our reaction to all that was no effing way. There is a fight to be had here. It's a legal fight. Trump has invoked his legal right to challenge all of the fraud that has taken place here. He has challenged the Democrats' attempt to steal this election, and I am convinced, after reviewing all of the fraud that has been reported and the legal claims that are being filed, I am convinced that Trump is going to come out on top. Now, the problem, it's not really a problem. It's just a reality. The media is not reporting anything about this. The most they even say about Trump's efforts in that department is that he is alleging election fraud without any proof, or that his claims of election fraud and voter fraud are baseless. If you do a Google search, the first several pages of Google results are all headlines. They're all the same. They're all the same. Trump alleges election fraud with no proof. Trump alleges baseless election fraud accusation. They're all the same. If you turn on any of these mainstream media channels, you wouldn't know that Trump secured a favorable U.S. Supreme Court order on Friday in the Pennsylvania matter. I explained that in the last episode. You wouldn't know that he's filed a lawsuit in federal court in Nevada over the lack of meaningful access to watch the vote counting, and the allegation that 10,000 non-residents voted in Nevada. So what I wanted to do at the beginning of this show today was to identify some of these key lawsuits that Trump has filed, where they've been filed, what each of these lawsuits is about, what they are challenging, and how they could potentially affect the outcome of this election. I spent some time discussing on Friday night's podcast the Pennsylvania situation, so I'm not going to go into too much detail there. And when I get to Pennsylvania, in my list of states here that I'm going to discuss, I'll again briefly allude to it. I also posted about the Pennsylvania issue and the Supreme Court order on our Facebook page and explained the issues there in a nutshell. So I'd invite you to refer back to that post and to our last episode to understand what's going on in that case, because it's critical and it bodes well for Trump's chances of reversing the result in Pennsylvania. Let me start with Arizona. So I've got a piece here from the Daily Wire. Now, when I explain some of these lawsuits, the Trump campaign is playing a lot of this close to the vest, and I think that that's smart because it limits the amount of information that's released to the media and to the Democrats. You never want to play all your cards or to reveal how many arrows you have in your quiver. They're playing all of this very close to the vest, and I think that that's very intelligent. So the information we have in Arizona is, according to the Daily Wire, the Trump campaign filed a lawsuit alleging that many in-person votes were rejected because people who came in to vote had accidentally overvoted, that is, voted accidentally for two people for the same office. The lawsuit alleges that those ballots were rejected as opposed to being allowed to correct their ballots. So that's one lawsuit pending in Arizona. Arizona has 11 electoral votes, and as of the last time I checked, Biden was up over 16,000 votes in Arizona. Last week, he was up over 90,000 votes. It's becoming clear that that state should not have been called as early as it did for Biden, because the votes in Maricopa County, which is a red county, were not finished being counted. I believe what Trump was saying last week, that when they finish counting the votes in Arizona, it's going to go back to Trump. It's going to be a red state. On top of that, you have these lawsuits challenging some of these issues with voting. So it could potentially help Trump widen his margin of victory in Arizona. Moving on to Georgia, I have a piece here from AP News. There's a Georgia lawsuit that was filed in Chatham County, essentially asking a judge to ensure that state laws are being followed on absentee ballots. There are a bunch of issues with absentee ballots in this election, and you're going to see what's happening in Wisconsin with absentee ballots. It is a freaking disaster what they try to do there. Campaign officials said they were considering peppering a dozen other counties around the state with similar claims around absentee ballots. So absentee ballots are governed by state law. Every state has a statute that identifies the requirements for an absentee ballot, for it to be valid, and for it to be counted. If an absentee ballot, generally speaking, if an absentee ballot does not comply with the requirements of the statute that applies to it, it is rejected and it is not counted. What we are seeing in a lot of these states is that, not coincidentally, folks, the states, the swing states that are run by Democrats, they're all undertaking efforts to count absentee ballots that do not comply with applicable requirements. This happened in Georgia, and that is one subject of a lawsuit that was filed there. I have a piece here from the Gateway Pundit, which says that there were 132,000 ballots in Fulton County, Georgia, that have been identified that are likely ineligible to be counted. They contain what are called change of address red flags, meaning the people who turned in those ballots had actually moved out of state and were not eligible to vote in Georgia. Now, the margin of victory in Georgia for Biden was minimal. Trump was ahead for a significant period of time, and then Biden pulled away. Georgia has 16 electoral votes, and as of the last time I checked, Biden was up over 10,000 votes in Georgia. So there are, depending on what happens with these issues concerning the Fulton County ballots and the lawsuit concerning the absentee ballots in Georgia, that small margin of victory for Biden is precarious for him, and there could be a significant reversal in Georgia depending on how these legal challenges turn out concerning those issues. Michigan is a disaster. Remember when I talked about the software glitch last episode that resulted in the vote totals in Antrim County being transposed for Biden and Trump? Once they were fixed, Trump picked up 3,000 votes. I believe that was the number, more or less. I posted that story on our Facebook page. Apparently, that software, it's called Dominion, is being used in 30 plus other counties in Michigan. And it's being used in every key swing state at issue here. That is a remarkable fact. Michigan has 16 electoral votes. As of the last time I checked, Biden was up over 145,000 votes in Michigan. Now, if Trump picks up thousands of votes in one county in Michigan, and there are 30 plus other counties where there could potentially be these software glitches. By the way, did you notice how the software glitch only goes in one direction? I thought a glitch creates some kind of chaos. And if I learned anything from The Joker in The Dark Knight, is that chaos is random. But there's no randomness about this set of circumstances here. So if there could potentially be these software glitches in these 30 plus other counties, those 145,000 votes by which Biden is ahead are in question. And I'm with Jay Sekulow on this. They should do a manual recount of every vote in those counties or states where this software was used. I mean, this is completely unacceptable. That on this level, one of the most important federal elections in the history of this country, and you're having software glitches on a vote counting software. I mean, this should be a non-debatable point. Recount wherever the software was used, because it's clearly producing critical errors that are affecting the outcome of some of these states. Nevada. Now, if you recall, I talked about the lawsuit filed in federal court in the last episode over the vote count and the meaningful access issue. That lawsuit also alleges that 10,000 non-residents voted when they should not have. I have another piece here from the Daily Wire explaining that another lawsuit is going to be filed in Nevada. It was probably filed yesterday, actually, on Monday. But there's no information yet that I've been able to uncover concerning that lawsuit or what it's about. So there are numerous legal challenges being filed in each of these states. Nevada has 6 electoral votes. And as of the last time I checked, Biden was up by over 34,000 votes in that state. Again, another small margin of victory for Biden that could be in play if these issues are resolved in Trump's favor. On to Pennsylvania. Now, I talked about the Supreme Court order on Friday. Trump campaign has also filed a lawsuit concerning access to the vote count in Pennsylvania. They were being excluded from the rooms where they were counting votes, Trump campaign members were, and they had to file a lawsuit and request an injunction, an order from the court directing election officials to allow Trump campaign members to watch the vote count. What's the problem with letting them watch the vote count? I'll never understand that. Why Democrats and election officials, these states are all controlled by Democrats, by the way, why they're preventing Trump campaign members from watching the vote count. What are you trying to hide? have a piece here from the Daily Wire. Rudy Giuliani, who's Trump's personal lawyer, says that he believes that there are 135,000 votes in Pennsylvania County and about 300 some odd thousand votes in Allegheny County that were put through without being inspected first. When votes come in, absentee or mail-in votes, these ballots, they need it, again, as I mentioned earlier, there is a statute that governs what information is supposed to be included on these ballots. Some of them require that a witness sign a certification that goes on the envelope, or that the voter has to include certain information on a certification form. Giuliani is talking about a whole bunch of ballots that were not inspected to ensure that they complied with statutory requirements for them. So that is obviously going to be subject of another legal challenge. Pennsylvania has 20 electoral votes, and as the last time I checked, Biden was up by over 45,000 votes in that state. So that is, again, those votes are in play here. The majority of these mail-in absentee ballots are coming in. They're all Biden votes, not all of them, but the majority of them are. If you start knocking out a bunch of these ballots, that 45,000 vote margin that Biden is up by is not going to be enough to sustain Pennsylvania for him. Now, according to CNN and Politico, Pennsylvania received nearly 2.6 million mail-in ballots. Recall, I talked about the Supreme Court order on Friday. That order directed Pennsylvania election officials to segregate ballots that came in after Election Day. Remember, the statute requires that mail-in ballots be in by 8 p.m. on Tuesday, Election Day. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court inserted language into the statute that's not there and held that ballots could be in by Friday as so long as they were postmarked by Tuesday. And then if a postmark was illegible or if there was no postmark, it was still valid. None of that's in the statute, by the way. But these judges figured that they could just rewrite the statute even though they're not part of the legislature. It's unclear how many of the 2.6 million mail-in ballots that were cast in Pennsylvania, it's unclear how many of those ballots came in after Election Day because election officials were not segregating them. And that is why Republicans went to the Supreme Court and applied for an order directing Pennsylvania officials to segregate those ballots. Because if you don't segregate them, then you can't determine which ones went for Biden and which ones went for Trump in determining which of the ballots were illegal, which of them did not comply with the statutory requirements. If you reject a ballot, you need to know which candidate that ballot is voting for, because that way you can then subtract the vote from that candidate. If you can't do that, if you're not segregating these ballots, then you lose. They're anonymous. Once you pull them out of the envelope and you don't inspect them and you don't segregate them, dump them in the machine, they're now anonymous. The vote goes for whichever candidate. Now you have no idea how many votes went for which candidate, how many illegal votes went for which candidate, and how many votes you then correspondingly need to subtract from that candidate. So that problem that's presented in Pennsylvania. Now, some conservative outlets like the American Thinker seem to be under the impression that if you remove the late mail-in ballots, assuming you can identify them if they've been segregated, if you remove those ballots, Trump wins Pennsylvania. I think that that's true. But again, it all is premised on being able to identify those ballots. I have a piece here from the Daily Wire. Lindsey Graham received a sworn affidavit from a man by the name of Richard Hopkins, an Erie, Pennsylvania mail carrier who claims he was instructed to collect late ballots with the apparent intent from Postmaster Rob Weisenbach to backdate the votes. Hopkins made the claims in a signed affidavit under the penalty of perjury. You know, all these liberals walking around claiming that there's no proof of fraud. This is a sworn affidavit. He made this under oath. He signed it under the pains and penalties of perjury. This is admissible evidence, otherwise known as proof, in support of a claim that the ballots that were generated from this effort are illegal. The article goes on. Although, as I understand Pennsylvania law, ballots must be postmarked by 8 p.m. on Election Day, November 3rd, 2020, in Pennsylvania, Postmaster Rob Weisenbach directed my co-workers, this is Mr. Hopkins, the one who prepared and signed this affidavit, Weisenbach directed my co-workers and I to pick up ballots after Election Day and provide them to him. The affidavit reads in part, adding, I heard Weisenbach tell a supervisor at my office that Weisenbach was backdating the postmarks on the ballots to make it appear as though the ballots had been collected on November 3rd, 2020, despite them, in fact, being collected on November 4th and possibly later. Come on! You've got to be kidding me! This is making the 2004 Ukraine election look like child's play. I mean, you want to talk about rigged elections in third world countries? What the hell is this? Ay, ay, ay. This is the best one. Wisconsin. I was having a conversation with the owner of a dive bar here in town in Manchester about this last night, and I he didn't know the story, and I told him, and he puts his hands on his face like he just could not believe it. So in Wisconsin, Trump already requested a recount in that state, so that's going to happen, but it's likely going to be difficult to make up the deficit that he faces in Wisconsin against Biden through a recount. Wisconsin has 10 electoral votes. As of the last time I checked, Biden was up over only 20,000 votes in Wisconsin. Now, recounts in the past in Wisconsin have resulted in just a difference of several hundred votes, so that's likely not going to do it for Trump. But there have been other developments in Wisconsin. Now, this is from Red State. Apparently, poll workers may have altered thousands of absentee ballots in violation of state law. Remember I mentioned there is a statute in every state that governs the requirements for absentee ballots. Wisconsin statute 6.86 through 6.88, they provide that an absentee ballot must be signed by a witness who is also required to list his or her address on a certification that goes on the envelope that contains the ballot. If a witness address is not listed, then the ballot is considered invalid and must be returned to the voter to have the witness correct. This article reads, in defiance of and direct contradiction to the statute, the Wisconsin Elections Commission gave guidance, that is, cover, to all 72 county clerks and turned the statute on his head, Gableman said. They said, gee, we know the law says an absentee ballot without the witness address is not valid. But, county clerk, you have a duty to go ahead and look up on your own the witness's address if there's no address on the absentee ballot. Anticipating a legal challenge to this seemingly highly unlawful advice, the Wisconsin... Oh, man, you cannot make this up. The Wisconsin Elections Commission instructed clerks to write... So, let me stop right here. Let's repeat the information. The statute says that there has to be a witness signature and a witness address. The Wisconsin Election Commission told all the county clerks that if the ballot does not contain that information, they can fill it in themselves. I mean, these Democrats, they think you're stupid. They think that you're stupid. They think that you weren't going to notice this. Let me finish reading this because it actually gets better than that. Anticipating a legal challenge to this seemingly highly unlawful advice, the Wisconsin Elections Commission instructed clerks to write in these witness addresses in red pen so they could be easy to find during a recount or audit of the vote. So they cheated, and then they deliberately leave evidence that they cheated. They don't even know how to cheat properly. The Republican Party of Wisconsin estimates that thousands of witness addresses may have been changed, thus invalidating the ballots on which they appeared. The statutory remedy for this is to subtract a commensurate number of votes for the candidates for whom those ballots were cast, meaning that vote totals may substantially change. So let's break this down again. There are two points I want to emphasize here. First, if the statute says if there's no witness address, then the absentee ballot is invalid, then it is invalid. There is nothing in the statute that permits a county clerk to fill in the witness address, himself or herself. For those of you who didn't go to law school, or who don't read and apply statutes, or litigate them regularly like I do, you're supposed to apply the plain language of the statute. If the language is clear, then that is the result that is dictated. It does not matter if it seems unfair, or inequitable, or harsh. That's the law. That is what occurs. If there's no provision or exception in the statute for researching and then writing in the witness's address, then that cannot be done. It's not allowed. Yet that's what these people were directed to do here. I alluded to this in the past episode about the lawsuits I've been handling here in New Hampshire concerning our governor's shutdown measures. Here, the governor has to declare a state of emergency before he can issue any specific emergency orders targeting any aspect of society, right? Such as social distancing measures for restaurants and so on and so forth. The statute in New Hampshire defines a state of emergency very specifically. It has to be some kind of natural or man-made disaster, something dire. Based on the COVID data I recited during that episode and even now, we have nothing like that in New Hampshire. Yet these judges are so resistant to the idea that if you apply the statute as written, there's no basis to declare a state of emergency. And they should strike the governor's renewal of a state of emergency declaration. But they find ways to perform these elaborate backflips just to continue to uphold the damn declaration. It infuriates me. So in this Wisconsin statute, there's nothing that permits a county clerk to fill in a witness's address or otherwise correct the ballot if it does not satisfy the requirements in the statute for absentee ballots. If that's an exception that people think should be added to make things fair, then that's for the legislature to do, not The Wisconsin legislature can pass a bill that proposes that change to the statute, and then they can vote on it. A county clerk is not a legislator. He or she is an executive official. And again, if you remember learning about the separation of powers in civics, the executive branch can only enforce the law, not make the law or change the law. A judge can only interpret and apply the law, not change it. If county clerks in Wisconsin did this, that is a gross abuse of power. To make matters worse, as I identified earlier, they filled in the addresses using red pen so they can track it during a recount or audit. I mean, are you freaking kidding me? I don't know whether these people are stupid or what, but then I stop myself and I think, no. They're not stupid. They think you're stupid. They think voters are stupid. They think the general electorate is stupid because they thought that you were not going to notice any of this. My understanding is the Trump campaign is going to challenge this, and it should be easy to do thanks to the benevolence of the Wisconsin County clerks because they can easily find the envelopes that contain red ink. Well, I'll get to this in a second. The problem is matching the envelope to the ballot and figuring out which candidate that ballot was cast for, because that's how you're going to determine how many votes to subtract from that candidate's vote total, and that's where it gets a little tricky. The second point I wanted to make concerning this Wisconsin story is the last line about the remedy for this kind of conduct. Now, I'm going to go into this in a second in a little bit more detail. I previously read that the statutory remedy for this in Wisconsin is to subtract the vote for the candidate for whom the ballot was cast. That statute is 6.88, and it does in fact say that if any number of things concerning an absentee ballot are not satisfied, including the certification of the witness, such as filling in the witness address, it says, and I quote, "The inspectors shall not count the ballot. They go into a rejection pile and then return to the county clerk." That is it. Nothing else can be done. You snooze, you lose. So if this is challenged in Wisconsin and these ballots were modified in this manner, they cannot be counted. Now, you need to match the ballot to the envelope that contains the modified certification for the witness. If you can do that, then those votes, you can determine which votes were cast for which illegal votes were cast for which candidate, and then you can subtract those votes from that candidate who received them. Now, before I get to the remedy issue, I have a piece here from the New Yorker from October 31st. During the primary in April earlier this year, 23,000 absentee ballots were thrown out in Wisconsin because they failed to comply with the onerous rules for absentee ballots in that state. The article states, "An analysis of absentee balloting in the April primary as COVID-19 took hold showed that about 23,000 ballots were thrown out. In a majority of cases, the ballot was rejected because the voter or the witness failed to sign the ballot envelope or include the address of the witness." I guess people can't follow the rules in Wisconsin. Man. "By comparison, Trump won Wisconsin 4 years ago by only 22,748 votes out of about 3 million cast. If next week's election..." This is an article from October 31st, by the way. "If next week's election is close, Democrats expect the Republicans will pay particular attention to absentee ballots in heavily Democratic areas, looking for reasons to disqualify them." According to the Wisconsin State Journal, in the 2016 and 2018 Wisconsin general elections, absentee ballots made up no more than 6% of the ballot. In April of this year, however, the portion jumped to more than 60% after the state instituted its stay-at-home order. 1.6 million ballots were cast in the April primary, according to ABC News. 23,000 ballots, a little over that, were thrown out, as I mentioned earlier. That's 1.4% of the entire ballot total in the state. Now, there were over 3.2 million ballots cast in Wisconsin in the general election last week. 6% of those ballots equates to 192,000 ballots. Remember, 60% of the ballots cast in April were absentee ballots. So let's assume half of the 3.2 million votes that were cast last week were absentee. That's 1.6 million absentee ballots. CNN said that there were 2 million absentee and early voting ballots cast in Wisconsin, so I'm not that far off. Now, if 1.4% of those 3.2 million ballots were thrown out because of absentee ballot errors, such as witness addresses, that's over 44,000 votes that could be eliminated. It's very likely that most of those votes are for Biden. His margin in Wisconsin, if you recall, is just a little over 20,000 votes. So there are clear issues to be looked at here, and they need to be challenged, and the Trump campaign is doing that. And just like Wisconsin is a good example, these challenges can make a difference in the outcome of this election. All of these challenges in these states, they put 80-some, I'm not going to do the math here right now, but I think there are 80-some electoral votes in play. That's a major swing in the Electoral College vote. Now, obviously, the question is going to be whether the number of votes for Biden that are being challenged will be enough to help Trump overcome the deficit he faces in some of these states. Based on these challenges and the number of votes that can be challenged. I believe he has a very good shot at eliminating scores of illegal votes and correcting this. And that raises a question. I haven't seen very many news outlets, I haven't seen anyone really cover this issue, and I think it's important to touch on. What is the remedy when you file a lawsuit alleging election fraud? So when I say remedy, remedy is an award or a result that you aim for when you file a lawsuit. There are two types of remedies in civil actions: monetary remedies and equitable remedies. A monetary remedy is just that. It's a remedy of money damages. So let's say, for example, you have a contract with somebody and you're supposed to render certain services. They're supposed to pay you, say, $50,000. They end up not paying you, and yet you perform the services, but they did not pay you. You file a lawsuit for breach of contract against the other individual or company, and the remedy you are seeking is the money you were owed under the contract. You're seeking a monetary remedy of $50,000. An equitable remedy is different. It doesn't concern money. It concerns a request for an order from the court that directs someone or something to do something or not do something. That's why it's called equity. In an election fraud or voter fraud lawsuit, these lawsuits tend to raise claims under the Voting Rights Act, under the Equal Protection Clause. They raise civil conspiracy claims at times. There are any number of claims that they can raise. But what is the remedy that will be awarded here in all of these lawsuits? There are actually several different types of remedies in these scenarios. Typical remedies for election fraud cases, and I've been researching all this, and I've read a lot of cases that have dealt with various types of election fraud issues. Typical remedies for election fraud cases include either a new election is ordered, or the election itself is invalidated and they keep the office vacant, or the court may defer to whatever state remedies exist or are articulated in the applicable statute that governs that situation. Or finally, the court may certify the losing candidate as the winner. Those are the four types of remedies that are usually given in these types of lawsuits. Practical realities obviously make selecting one of these remedies a little bit difficult. So for instance, in some of these cases, courts, they won't invalidate an election or order a new election, inconveniences these citizens, or it renders the office vacant for a significant period of time. In addition, vacating an office or ordering another candidate to assume office may not necessarily restore the confidence of the electorate in the process or in having fair elections. The most popular remedy that I have seen is invalidating the old election and ordering a new election. When someone commits an illegal act or an act that was not authorized under some authority like a statute or a rule or a regulation, that act, if you go to court and you challenge the legality of that act is invalidated, meaning it's erased. It's like it never happened. So the most popular remedy ordered by many of these cases is that the election in which the fraud occurred is erased and a new election is. Now that remedy, if you think about it, may not have a large deterrent effect because it effectively rewards the candidate who committed the fraud or the party that committed the fraud with a second opportunity to campaign and perhaps commit the fraud again but conceal it better or employ a new strategy or what have you. So, you know, there is no perfect remedy, but the most popular one seems to be ordering a new election. Now, at times, courts may certify the loser of the election as the winner. That presents some difficulties as well. How do you determine that? Can you determine that but for the fraud, the candidate who lost would have won? That requires expert testimony and statistical analysis and many other factors and measures, and it's just beyond the scope of this conversation. But the most popular remedy seems to be ordering a new election. So that comes into play, for example, in Wisconsin. If you cannot identify or connect the vote to the envelope whose witness address was filled in, then you don't know which candidate to subtract that vote from. The statute says that if the ballot does not comply with the statutory requirements, then it's rejected. So that's the remedy in the statute, but you can't apply that remedy if you can't connect the vote to the ineligible envelope with the filled-in witness address on the witness certification. So in that scenario, what I think a court would do with a legal challenge to that is just invalidate the result and order a new election in Wisconsin. Now, I'm convinced that if new elections are ordered in any of these states, swing states, Trump's going to win every one of those. Most of the Biden votes came in on mail-in and absentee ballots. And if you're going to force these people to have to do that again, that's going to be a nightmare. And if the Democrats can't cheat this time around, they're not going to be able to win. I'm convinced that if new elections are ordered, Trump's going to win every single one of those. And I think that is likely going to be the most popular remedy that is awarded here.
From the New York Post, Trump campaign advisor Jason Miller, the word concede isn't in their vocabulary. This is about
the betterment of the United States as they were aiming to ensure free and fair elections. This is much more about the entire future of elections in America, he explained. This is about election integrity. If we can't get this right, why think we will ever have confidence in these elections going forward, he continued. There are two points here that I want to emphasize. The first one is people don't understand Trump's DNA. One of my favorite documentaries the last few years was this past summer on ESPN. It was called The Last Dance. Many people know about it and watched it. The Last Dance chronicled the last year of the Chicago Bulls dynasty when they had Michael Jordan. If there's anything that documentary does very well, it's that it communicates not only how good Jordan was, but how obsessive he was about winning. He refused to back down from a challenge. He refused to allow his teammates to be intimidated by anything. He would find ways to motivate himself when there seemingly wasn't any reason to prop himself up or when you'd run out of reasons to do so. We often have those days where we just want to lie in bed or days when we want to just mail it in. Jordan did not have those days. He was absolutely relentless. He did not care if he seemed like a jerk or a tyrant. That's the way he played the game, and he only knew how to play that way. He didn't want to lose, and he would do whatever it takes to win. Trump is a lot like that, in a different way, obviously. What liberals have never understood about Trump is that he also is never intimidated by a challenge, particularly the media, as it constantly chastises him, makes fun of him, and comes after him, and accuses him of illegal conduct and this and that. A lot of Republicans over the years would back down from stuff like that. They would become intimidated by those tactics. Trump never has been. I'll never forget during the 2016 election when the Access Hollywood story broke. That was the recording that caught Trump bragging about how he would approach and deal with women. You know, the famous line he uttered, grab them by the you know what. I can't say that word because my mom listens to this podcast and I'll get in trouble with her if I say that word. So everyone on the left thought Trump was toast after that story broke. And indeed, any other Republican in his shoes, he was the Republican nominee for president, for crying out loud. Any other Republican in his shoes at that time would have held a press conference and apologized and tried to appease the media and done interviews and on and on. And not Trump. He dismissed it out of hand. At the next debate with Hillary, he labeled it locker room talk. And just like that, it became insignificant. It was brilliant. But it took somebody with his nerves of steel to do that. And here's the other thing they don't understand about Trump. Not only does he not back down, he fights back and often picks the fight himself. He is a brawler, and his supporters love that. Before that debate, he held a press conference with several women who had accused Bill Clinton of various transgressions in the early 1990s and had exposed his philandering ways. Trump held a press conference with those women and invited them to sit in the front row at the debate he had against Hillary. That is the kind of fighter that he is. He has the same mentality with this election. He's going to go on the offensive with these allegations of voter fraud. And I'm telling you, he is going to expose what the Democrats have done here to try and steal this election. The second point I wanted to make about the comments from the article I just read concerning Trump's senior advisor, it's the last sentence that I read and that he uttered. And it's this. This is about election integrity. These lawsuits are about preserving confidence in our elections. As much as we want Trump to win re-election, his effort with these legal challenges is even more critical for preserving the integrity of our electoral system. People need to have confidence in the results of our elections. That should be a unifying theme here, but it's not. The media and the Democrats are doing everything possible to dismiss these efforts and label Trump's allegations baseless and false. But there is no reason why we cannot agree on this. There's no reason why we cannot agree that if there was fraud in this election, it has to be exposed, and it has to be prevented from happening again. When Al Gore filed a lawsuit in 2000, no one criticized him or his campaign for doing that. The Bush campaign patiently waited while that lawsuit was resolved. 37 days. That's good for our constitutional republic. We have to have confidence in our elections. A free society requires free and fair elections. If not, there is no freedom. We need to be able to choose our leaders in a transparent way that inspires and preserves confidence in the system. People should be applauding Trump for, once again, taking the fight to the system and draining the system of the corruption that has plagued it for so many years. I believe he will succeed in exposing the fraud that took place here, and that is critical for our republic to survive. That is all for this episode. I want to thank you again for listening to the Law of FOHO podcast. Make sure to join our Facebook group at Law of FOHO if you haven't already, where we break down the issues in each episode throughout the week, and we also post helpful and insightful information related to the show and the topics we discuss. Follow us also on Instagram at Law of FOHO and Twitter. Our handle is at Law of FOHO. Thank you very much, and we will see you again soon.